Inca Gold by Clive Cussler. Prologue. The Mysterious Intruders. A.D. 1533. A Forgotten Sea. They came from the south with the morning sun, shimmering like ghosts in a desert mirage as they slipped across the sun-sparkled water. The rectangular cotton sails on the flotilla of rafts sagged lifelessly under a placid azure sky. No commands were spoken as the crews dipped and pulled their paddles in eerie silence. Overhead a hawk swooped and soared, as if guiding the steersman toward a barren island that rose from the center of the inland sea. The rafts were constructed of reed bundles bound and turned up at both ends. Six of these bundles made up one hull, which was keeled and beamed with bamboo. The raised prow and stern were shaped like serpents with dog heads, their jaws tilted toward the sky, as if baying at the moon. The lord in command of the fleet sat on a throne-like chair perched on the pointed bow of the lead raft. He wore a cotton tunic adorned with turquoise platelets and a wool mantle of multicolored embroidery. His head was covered with a plumed helmet and a face mask of gold. Ear ornaments, a massive necklace, and arm bracelets also gleamed yellow under the sun. Even his shoes were fashioned from gold. What made the sight even more astonishing was that the crew members were adorned no less magnificently. Along the shoreline of the fertile land surrounding the sea, the local native society watched in fear and wonder as the foreign fleet intruded into their waters. There were no attempts at defending their territory against invaders. They were simple hunters and foragers who trapped rabbits, caught fish, and harvested a few seeded plants and nuts. Theirs was an archaic culture, curiously unlike their neighbors to the east and south who built widespread empires. They lived and died without ever constructing massive temples to a race of gods, and now watched in fascination at the display of wealth and power that moved across the water. As one mind, they saw the fleet as a miraculous appearance of warrior gods from the spirit world. The mysterious strangers took no notice of the people crowding the shore and continued paddling toward their destination. They were on a sanctified mission and ignored all distractions. They propelled their craft impassively, not one head turned to acknowledge their stunned audience. They headed straight for the steep, rock-blanketed slopes of a small mountain making up an island that rose 200 meters, 656 feet, from the surface of the sea. It was uninhabited and mostly barren of plant life. To the local people who lived on the mainland it was known as the Dead Giant, because the crest of the long, low mountain resembled the body of a woman lying in wakeless sleep. The sun added to the illusion by giving it a glow of unearthly radiance. Soon the lustrously attired crewmen grounded their rafts on a small pebble-strewn beach that opened into a narrow canyon. They lowered their sails, woven with huge figures of supernatural animals, symbols that added to the hushed fear and reverence of the native onlookers, and began unloading large reed baskets and ceramic jars onto the beach. Throughout the long day the cargo was stacked in an immense but orderly pile. In the evening, as the sun fell to the west, all view of the island from the shore was cut off. Only the faint flicker of lights could be seen through the darkness. But in the dawn of the new day, the fleet was still snug on shore, and the great mound of cargo was unmoved. On top of the island mountain, much labor was being expended by stone workers assaulting a huge rock. Over the next 6 days and nights, using bronze bars and chisels, they laboriously pecked and hammered the stone until it slowly took on the shape of a fierce winged jaguar with the head of a serpent. When the final cutting and grinding were finished, the grotesque beast appeared to leap from the great rock it was carved upon. During the sculpting process, the cargo of baskets and jars was slowly removed until there was no longer any trace. Then one morning the inhabitants looked across the water at the island and found it empty of life. The enigmatic people from the south, along with their fleet of rafts, had disappeared, having sailed away under cover of darkness. Only the imposing stone jaguar, serpent, its teeth curved in a bed of bared fangs, and with slitted eyes surveying the vast terrain of endless hills beyond the small sea, remained to mark their passage. Curiosity quickly outweighed fear. The next afternoon, four men from the main village along the coast of the inland sea, their courage boosted by a potent native brew, pushed off in a dugout canoe and paddled across the water to the island to investigate. After landing on the little beach, they were observed entering the narrow canyon leading inside the mountain. All day and into the next, their friends and relatives anxiously awaited their return. But the men were never seen again. Even their canoe vanished. The primitive fear of the local people increased when a great storm suddenly swept the small sea and turned it into a raging tempest. The sun blinked out as the sky went blacker than anyone could ever remember. The frightening darkness was accompanied by a terrible wind that shrieked and churned the sea to froth and devastated the coastal villages. It was as though a war of the heavens had erupted. The violence lashed the shoreline with unbelievable fury. The natives were certain the gods of the sky and darkness were led by the jaguar serpent to punish them for their intrusion. They whispered of a curse against those who dared trespass on the island. Then, as abruptly as it came, the storm passed over the horizon and the wind died to a baffling stillness. The brilliance of the sun burst onto a sea as calm as before. Then gulls appeared and wheeled in a circle above an object that had been washed onto the sandy beach of the eastern seashore. When the people saw the unmoving form lying in the tide line, they approached warily and stopped, then cautiously moved forward and peered down to examine it. They gasped as they realized it was the dead body of one of the strangers from the south. He wore only an ornate, embroidered tunic. All trace of golden face mask, helmet, and bracelets was gone. Those present at the macabre scene stared in shock at the appearance of the corpse. Unlike the dark-skinned natives with their jet-black hair, the dead man had white skin and blonde hair. His eyes were staring sightless and blue. If standing, he would have stood a good half-head taller than the astonished people studying him. Trembling with fear, they tenderly carried him to a canoe and gently lowered him inside. Then two of the bravest men were chosen to transport the body to the island. Upon reaching the beach, they quickly laid him on the sand and paddled furiously back to shore. Years after those who witnessed the remarkable event had died, the bleached skeleton could still be observed, partly embedded in the sand, as a morbid warning to stay off the island. It was whispered the golden warrior's guardian, the winged jaguar serpent, had devoured the inquisitive men who trespassed its sanctuary, and no one ever again dared risk its wrath by setting foot on the island. There was an eerie quality, almost a ghostliness, about the island. It became a sacred place that was only mentioned in hushed voices and never visited. Who were the warriors in gold, and where did they come from? Why had they sailed into the inland sea, and what did they do there? The witnesses had to accept what they had seen. No explanation was possible. Without knowledge, the myths were born. Legends were created and nurtured when the surrounding land was shaken by an immense earthquake that destroyed the shoreline villages. When, after 5 days, the tremors finally died away, the great inland sea had vanished, leaving only a thick ring of shells on what was once a shoreline. The mysterious intruders soon wove their way into religious tradition and became gods. Through time, stories of their sudden manifestation and disappearance grew, and then eventually faded, until they were but a bit of vague supernatural folklore handed down from generation to generation by a people who lived in a haunted land where unexplained phenomena hovered like smoke over a campfire. Cataclysm. March 1, 1578. West coast of Peru. Captain Juan de Anton, a brooding man with Castilian green eyes and a precisely trimmed black beard, peered through his spyglass at the strange ship following in his wake, and raised his eyebrows in mild surprise. A chance encounter, he wondered, or a planned interception? On the final lap of a voyage from Callao de Lima, de Anton had not expected to meet other treasure galleons bound for Panama, where the king's wealth would be packed aboard mules for a journey across the isthmus, and then shipped over the Atlantic to the coffers of Seville. He perceived a trace of French design in the hull and rigging of the stranger trailing his wake a league and a half astern. If he had been sailing the Caribbean trade routes to Spain, de Anton would have shunned contact with other ships. But his suspicions cooled slightly when he spied an enormous flag streaming from a tall staff on the stern. Like his own ensign, snapping tautly in the wind, it sported a white background with the rampant red cross of 16th-century Spain. Still, he felt a trifle uneasy. De Anton turned to his second-in-command and chief pilot, Luis Torres.
"What do you make of her, Luis?"
Torres, a tall, clean-shaven Galician, shrugged. "Too small for a bullion galleon. I judge her to be a wine merchantman out of Valparaiso, heading for port in Panama, the same as we."
"You do not think there is a possibility she might be an enemy of Spain?"
"Impossible. No enemy ships have ever dared attempt the passage through the treacherous labyrinth of the Magellan Strait around South America." Reassured, de Anton nodded. "Since we have no fear of them, being French or English, let us put about and greet them." Torres gave the order to the steersman, who sighted his course across the gun deck from under a raised trunk on the deck above. He manhandled a vertical pole that pivoted on a long shaft that turned the rudder. "The Nuestra Señora de la Concepción, the largest and most regal of the Pacific Armada treasure galleons, leaned onto her port side and came around on a reverse course to the southwest. Her 9 sails filled from a swift easterly offshore breeze that pushed her 570-ton bulk through the rolling swells at a comfortable 5 knots. Despite her majestic lines and the ornate carvings and colorful art designs painted on the sides of her high stern and forecastle, the galleon was a tough customer. Extremely rugged and seaworthy, she was the workhorse of the ocean-going vessels of her time. And if need be, she could slug it out with the best privateers a marauding sea nation could throw at her to defend the precious treasure in her cargo holds. To the casual eye, the treasure galleon looked to be a threatening warship bristling with armament. But surveyed from the inside, she could not conceal her true purpose as a merchant ship. Her gun decks held ports for nearly 50 4-pound cannon. But, lulled by the Spanish belief that the South Seas were their private pond, and the knowledge that none of their ships had ever been attacked or captured by a foreign raider, the Concepcion was lightly armed with only 2 guns to reduce her tonnage so she could carry heavier cargo.
Now feeling that his ship was in no danger, Captain de Anton casually sat on a small stool and resumed peering through his spyglass at the rapidly approaching ship. It never occurred to him to alert his crew for battle, just to be on the safe side. He had no certain foreknowledge, not even a vague premonition, that the ship he had turned to meet was the Golden Hind, captained by England's indefatigable sea-dog, Francis Drake, who stood on his quarter-deck and calmly stared back at de Anton through a telescope, with the cold eye of a shark following a trail of blood.
"Damned considerate of him to come about and meet us," muttered Drake. A beady-eyed gamecock of a man with dark red curly hair, complemented by a light sandy beard that tapered to a sharp point under a long swooping mustache.
"The very least he could do after we've chased his wake for the past 2 weeks," replied Thomas Cuttle, sailing master of the Golden Hind.
"Aye, but she's a prize worth chasing."
Already laden with gold and silver bullion, a small chest of precious stones, and valuable linens and silks, after capturing a score of Spanish ships, since becoming the first English vessel to sail into the Pacific, the Golden Hind, formerly named the Pelican, pounded through the waves like a beagle after a fox. She was a stout and sturdy vessel with an overall length of about 31 meters, 102 feet, and a displacement tonnage of 140. She was a good sailor and answered the helm well. Her hull and masts were far from new, but, after a lengthy refit at Plymouth, she had been made ready for a voyage that was to take her 55,000 kilometers, over 34,000 miles, around the world in 35 months, in one of the greatest sea epics of all time.
"Do you wish to cut across her bow and rake the Spanish jackals?" Cuttle inquired.
Drake dropped his long telescope, shook his head, and smiled broadly. "The better part of courtesy would be to trim sail and greet them like proper gentlemen." Cuttle stared uncomprehending at his audacious commander.
"But suppose they've put about to give battle?"
"Not damned likely her captain has a notion as to who we are."
"She's twice our size," Cuttle persisted.
"According to the sailors we captured at Callao de Lima, the Concepcion carries only 2 guns. The Hind boasts 18.
"Spaniards," Cuttle spit. "They lie worse than the Irish."
Drake pointed at the unsuspecting ship approaching bow on.
"Spanish ship captains run rather than fight," he reminded his feisty subordinate. "Then why not stand off and blast her into submission?"
"Not wise to fire our guns and run the risk of sinking her with all her loot." Drake clapped a hand on Cuttle's shoulder.
"Not to fear, Thomas. If I scheme a crafty plan, we'll save our powder and rely on stout Englishmen who are spoiling for a good fight."
Cuttle nodded in understanding.
"You mean to grapple and board her, then?"
Drake nodded.
"We'll be on her decks before her crew can prime a musket. They don't know it yet, but they're sailing into a trap of their own making."
Slightly after 3 in the afternoon, the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción came about on a parallel course to the northwest again, and ranged toward the Golden Hind's port quarter. Torres climbed the ladder to his ship's forecastle and shouted across the water.
"What ship are you?"
Numa de Silva, a Portuguese pilot Drake had appropriated after capturing de Silva's ship off Brazil, replied in Spanish,
"San Pedro de Paula out of Valparaiso,"
the name of a vessel Drake had seized 3 weeks earlier. Except for a few crew members who were dressed as Spanish sailors, Drake had hidden the mass of his men below decks and armed them with protective coats of mail and an arsenal of pikes, pistols, muskets, and cutlasses.
Grappling hooks attached to stout ropes were stowed along the bulwarks on the top deck. Crossbowmen were secretly stationed in the fighting tops above the mainyards of the masts. Drake forbade firearms in the fighting tops, where musket fire could easily ignite the sails into sheets of flame. The mainsails were hauled up and furled to give the bowmen an unobscured line of vision. Only then did he relax and patiently wait for the moment to attack. The fact that his Englishmen numbered 88 against the Spanish crew of nearly 200 bothered him not at all. It was not the first time, nor the last, he would ignore superior odds. His renowned fight against the Spanish Armada in the English Channel was yet to come. From his view, de Anton saw no unusual activity on the decks of the seemingly friendly and businesslike ship. The crew looked to be going about their duties without undue curiosity toward the Concepcion. The captain, he observed, leaned casually against the railing of the quarter-deck and saluted de Anton. The newcomer seemed deceptively innocent as it unobtrusively angled closer to the big treasure galleon. When the gap between the two ships had narrowed to 30 meters, 97 feet, Drake gave an almost imperceptible nod, and his ship's finest sharpshooter, who lay concealed on the gun-deck, fired his musket and struck the Concepcion's steersman in the chest. In unison, the crossbowmen in the fighting tops began picking off the Spaniards manning the sails. Then, with the galleon losing control of its steerage-way, Drake ordered his helmsman to run the hind alongside the bigger vessel's high-sloping hull. As the ships crushed together and their beams and planking groaned in protest, Drake roared out, "Win her for good Queen Bess and England, my boys!" Grappling hooks soared across the railings, clattered and caught on the Concepcion's bulwarks and rigging, binding the two vessels together in a death grip. Drake's crew poured onto the galleon's deck, screaming like banshees. His bandsmen added to the terror by beating on drums and blaring away on trumpets. Musket balls and arrows showered the dumbfounded Spanish crew as they stood frozen in shock. It was over minutes after it began. A third of the galleon's crew fell dead or wounded without firing a shot in their defense. Stunned by confusion and fear, they dropped to their knees in submission as Drake's crew of boarders brushed them aside and charged below decks. Drake rushed up to Captain de Anton, pistol in one hand, cutlass in the other. "Yield in the name of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth of England," he bellowed above the din. Dazed and incredulous, de Anton surrendered his ship. "I yield," he shouted back. "Take mercy on my crew." "I do not deal in atrocities," Drake informed him. As the English took control of the galleon, the dead were thrown overboard and the surviving crew and their wounded were confined in a hold. Captain de Anton and his officers were escorted across a plank laid between the two ships onto the deck of the Golden Hind. Then, with the characteristic courtesy that Drake always displayed toward his captives, he gave Captain de Anton a personally guided tour of the Golden Hind. Afterward he treated all the galleon's officers to a gala dinner, complete with musicians playing stringed instruments, solid silver tableware, and the finest of recently liberated Spanish wines. Even while they were dining, Drake's crewmen turned the ships to the west and sailed beyond Spanish sea lanes. The following morning they heaved to, trimming the sails so that the ship's speed fell off, but they maintained enough headway to keep the bows up to the seas. The next 4 days were spent transferring the fantastic treasure trove from the cargo holds of the Concepcion to the Golden Hind. The vast plunder included 13 chests of royal silver plate and coins, 80 pounds of gold, 26 tons of silver bullion, hundreds of boxes containing pearls and jewels, mostly emeralds, and a great quantity of food stores, such as fruits and sugar. The catch was to be the richest prize taken by a privateer for several decades. There was also a hold full of precious and exotic Inca artifacts that were being transported to Madrid for the personal pleasure of His Catholic Majesty Philip II, the King of Spain. Drake studied the artifacts with great astonishment. He had never seen anything like them. Reams of intricately embroidered Andean textiles filled one section of the hold from deck to ceiling. Hundreds of crates contained intricately sculpted stone and ceramic figures, mingled with highly crafted masterpieces of carved jade, superb mosaics of turquoise and shell, all plundered from sacred religious temples of the Andean civilizations overrun by Francisco Pizarro and succeeding armies of gold-hungry conquistadors. It was a glimpse of magnificent artistry that Drake never dreamed existed. Oddly, the item that interested him most was not a masterwork of three-dimensional art inlaid with precious stones, but rather a simple box carved from jade with the mask of a man for a lid. The masked lid sealed so perfectly the interior was nearly airtight. Inside was a multicolored tangle of long cords of different thicknesses with over 100 knots. Drake took the box back to his cabin and spent the better part of a day studying the intricate display of cords tied to lesser cords in vibrantly dyed colors, with the knots tied at strategic intervals. A gifted navigator and an amateur artist, Drake realized that it was either a mathematical instrument or a method of recording dates as a calendar. Intrigued by the enigma, he tried unsuccessfully to determine the meaning behind the colored strands and the different disposition of the knots. The solution was as obscure to him as to a native trying to interpret latitude and longitude on a navigational chart. Drake finally gave up and wrapped the jade box in linen. Then he called for Cuttle. "The Spaniard rides higher in the water with most of her riches relieved," Cuttle announced jovially as he entered the captain's cabin. "You have not touched the artworks?" Drake asked. "As you ordered, they remain in the galleon's hold." Drake rose from his work table and walked over to the large window and stared at the Concepcion. The galleon's sides were still wet, several feet above her present waterline. "The art treasures were meant for King Philip," he said. "Better they should go to England and be presented to Queen Bess." "The hind is already dangerously overladen," Cuttle protested. "By the time another 5 tons are loaded aboard, the sea will be lapping at our lower gun ports, and she won't answer the helm. She'll founder sure as heaven if we take her back through the tempest of Magellan Strait."
"I don't intend to return through the strait," said Drake. "My plan is to head north in search of a northwest passage to England. If that is not successful, I'll follow in Magellan's wake across the Pacific and around Africa."
"The hind will never see England, not with her cargo holds busting their seams."
"We'll jettison the bulk of the silver on Cano Island off Ecuador, where we can salvage it on a later voyage. The art goods will remain on the Concepcion."
"But what of your plan to give them to the Queen?"
"That still stands," Drake assured him. "You, Thomas, will take 10 men from the hind and sail the galleon to Plymouth."
Cuttle spread his hands in anguish.
"I can't possibly sail a vessel her size with only 10 men, not through heavy seas."
Drake walked back to his work table and tapped a pair of brass dividers on a circle marked on a chart.
"On charts I found in Captain de Anton's cabin, I've indicated a small bay on the coast north of here that should be free of Spaniards. You will sail there and cast off the Spanish officers and all wounded crewmen. Impress 20 of the remaining able-bodied seamen to man the vessel. I'll see you're supplied with more than enough weapons to preserve command and prevent any attempt to wrest control of the ship."
Cuttle knew it was useless to object. Debating with a stubborn man like Drake was a lost cause. He accepted his assignment with a resigned shrug.
"I will, of course, do as you command." Drake's face was confident, his eyes warm. "If anyone can sail a Spanish galleon up to the dock at Plymouth, Thomas, you can. I suspect you'll knock the eyes out of the Queen's head when you present her with your cargo. I would rather leave that piece of work to you, Captain."
Drake gave Cuttle a friendly pat on one shoulder.
"Not to fear, my old friend. I'm ordering you to be standing dockside with a wench on each arm, waiting to greet me when the Hind arrives home." At sunrise the following morning, Cuttle ordered the crewmen to cast off the lines binding the two ships. Safely tucked under one arm was the linen-wrapped box that Drake had directed him to personally give to the Queen. He carried it to the captain's cabin and locked it inside a cabinet in the captain's quarters. Then he returned to deck and took command of the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción as she drifted away from the Golden Hind. Sails were set under a dazzling crimson sun, the superstitious crews on both ships solemnly described as red as a bleeding heart. To their primitive way of thinking, it was considered a bad omen. Drake and Cuttle exchanged final waves as the Golden Hind set a course to the northeast. Cuttle watched the smaller ship until she was hull down over the horizon. He did not share Drake's confidence. A deep feeling of foreboding settled in the pit of his stomach. Several days later, after dumping many tons of silver ingots and coins off Cano Island to lighten her draft, the sturdy Hind and the intrepid Drake sailed north, to what would be known more than 2 centuries later as Vancouver Island, before turning west across the Pacific on their epic voyage. Far to the south, the Concepcion tacked and headed due east, making landfall and reaching the bay marked on the Spanish chart by Drake sometime late the next evening. The anchor was dropped and the watchlights set. Daylight brought the sun shining down over the Andes as Cuttle and his crew discovered a large native village of more than 1,000 inhabitants, surrounded by a large bay. Without wasting time, he ordered his men to begin ferrying the Spanish officers and their wounded to shore. 20 of the best seamen among the survivors were offered 10 times their Spanish pay to help sail the galleon to England, where they were promised to be set free upon landing. All 20 gladly signed on. Cuttle was standing on the gun deck overseeing the landing operation just after midday, when the ship began to vibrate as though a giant hand were rocking it. Everyone immediately stared at the long stream-like ensigns tied to the top of the masts. But only the ends of their tails fluttered under a slight whisper of wind. Then every eye turned to shore, where a great cloud of dust rose from the base of the Andes and appeared to be moving toward the sea. A frightening thundering sound increased to deafening proportions along with a tremendous convulsion of the earth. As the crew gawked in stunned fascination, the hills east of the village seemed to rise and fall like breakers rolling on a shallow shore. The dust cloud descended on the village and swallowed it. Above the uproar came the screams and cries of the villagers and the crashing sounds of their rock and adobe mud houses, as they shook apart and crumbled into ruin. None of the crew had ever experienced an earthquake, and few were even aware of such a phenomenon. Half the Protestant English and every one of the Catholic Spaniards on the galleon dropped to their knees and began praying fervently to God for deliverance. In minutes the dust cloud passed over the ship and dispersed out to sea. They all stared uncomprehendingly at what had been a thriving village bustling with activity. Now it was nothing but flattened ruins. Cries came from those trapped under the debris. A later estimate would show that less than 50 of the local inhabitants survived. The Spaniards on shore ran up and down the beach in panic, shouting and begging to be brought back to the ship. Collecting his senses, Cuttle ignored the pleas, ran to the railing and scanned the surrounding sea. Beyond showing a mild chop,
The water appeared indifferent to the nightmare tragedy in the village. Suddenly desperate to escape the cataclysm on shore, Cuttle began shouting orders to get the galleon under way. The Spanish prisoners cooperated wholeheartedly, working alongside the English to unfurl the sails and pull in the anchor. Meanwhile, the survivors from the village crowded the beach, imploring the galleon's crew to return and help them rescue their relatives from the shattered wreckage and carry them aboard the ship to safety. The seamen turned deaf ears to the pleas, concerned only with their own preservation. Suddenly, another earthquake shook the land, accompanied by an even more thunderous roar. The terrain began to undulate as if some monster were shaking a giant carpet. This time the sea slowly rolled back, stranding the Concepcion and exposing the floor of the sea. The seamen, none of whom knew how to swim, possessed an unnatural fear of what was under the water. Now they stared wonderingly at the sight of thousands of fish flipping about like wingless birds amid the rocks and corals where they had been left high and dry by the retreating sea. Sharks, squid, and a rainbow of tropical fish all mingled together in their death throes. A constant flow of tremors moved the earth as the submarine quake caused crustal fracturing, collapsing the seafloor and creating a vast depression. Then it was the sea's turn to go crazy as it swept in from all sides to fill the hole. The water piled up in a gigantic countersurge with incredible speed. Millions of tons of pure destruction rose higher and higher, until its crest reached 40 meters, 157 feet high, a phenomenon that would later become known as a tsunami. There was no time for the helpless men to clutch a solid object for support, no time for the devout to pray. Paralyzed and speechless in fear of the green and froth-white mountain of water rising before their eyes, they could only stand and watch it rush toward them with the ungodly sounds of a thousand hells. Only Cuttle had the presence of mind to run under the protecting deck over the tiller and wrap his limbs around its long wooden shaft. Bow on to the colossal wall of water, the Concepcion arched and soared vertically toward the curling crest. Moments later she was engulfed in a boiling turbulence as nature ran berserk. Now that the mighty torrent had the Concepcion in its grasp, it hurled the galleon toward the devastated shore at tremendous speed. Most of the crew on the open decks were snatched away and never seen again. The poor souls on the beach and those struggling to free themselves from the wreckage of the village were inundated as if a sudden gush of water had rushed over an ant's nest.
The poor souls on the beach and those struggling to free themselves from the wreckage of the village were inundated as if a sudden gush of water had rushed over an ant's nest. 1 second they were there, the next they were gone, mere bits and pieces of smashed debris being hurled toward the Andes. Buried under the towering mass of water for what seemed an incredible length of time, Cuttle held his breath until his lungs turned to fire and gripped the tiller as if he were a mutated branch that had grown from it. Then, with every one of her beams howling and creaking at their joints, the tough old ship battled her way back to the surface. How long she was swept through the swirling vortex, Cuttle could not remember. The violent surge totally erased what was left of the village. The few drenched men who somehow remained alive on the battered Concepcion were even further terrorized by the sight of centuries-dead mummies of the ancient Incas rising to the surface and surrounding the ship. Torn by the wave from their graves in some long-forgotten burial ground, the amazingly well-preserved bodies of the dead stared sightlessly at the horrified sailors, who were certain they were being cursed by creatures of the devil. Cuttle attempted to move the tiller as if steering the ship. His was a useless gesture, as the rudder had been ripped off its pintles soon after the wave struck. He clung tenaciously to life, his fear heightened by the mummies that swirled around the galleon. The worst was far from over. The mad swirl of the tidal current caused a vortex that spun the galleon with such force the masts went crashing over the sides,
and the two guns broke their lashings and tumbled about the deck in a wild dance of destruction. One by one the fear-crazed seamen were swept away by the gyrating avalanche of water, until only Cuttle was left. The enormous surge smashed and ravaged its way 8 kilometers, 5 miles inland, uprooting and shredding trees until over 100 square kilometers, 62 square miles, were utterly devastated. Massive boulders were scattered ahead of the wave's force like small pebbles thrown by a boy's sling. Then, at last, as the Leviathan of Death met the foothills of the Andes, it began to lose momentum. Its fury spent, it lapped at the foot of the mountains and finally began to recede with a great sucking sound, leaving in its wake a swath of destruction unknown in recorded history. Cuttle felt the galleon become motionless. He stared across the gun deck covered with fallen rigging and timbers, unable to see another living soul. For nearly an hour he huddled under the tiller, fearing a return of the murderous wave. But the ship remained still and silent. Slowly, stiffly, he made his way to the top of the quarter-deck and surveyed the scene of devastation. Astoundingly, the Concepcion sat upright, high and dry in a flattened jungle. He judged her to be almost 3 leagues from the nearest water. Her survival was due to her rugged construction and the fact she was sailing into the wave when it struck. If she had been sailing away, the watery force would have smashed into her high stern castle and ripped her to kindling. She had endured, but she was a wreck that would never feel the sea beneath her keel again. Far in the distance, the village had disappeared. All that remained was a wide beach of sand swept free of wreckage. It was as if 1,000 people and their homes had never existed. Corpses littered the drenched jungle. To Cuttle, they seemed to be scattered everywhere, in some places over 3 meters deep, 10 feet. Many were hanging grotesquely in the twisted branches of the trees. Most had been battered into almost unrecognizable shapes. Cuttle could not believe he was the only human to survive the cataclysm, and yet he failed to see another living soul. He thanked God for his deliverance and prayed for guidance. Then he took stock of his situation. Stranded 14,000 nautical miles from England, deep in a part of the world controlled by the Spanish, who would gladly torture and execute a hated English pirate should they lay hands on him, his odds of living a long life were slim indeed. Cuttle saw absolutely no hope of returning home by sea. He decided his only course, one with little probability of success, was to trek over the Andes and work east. Once he reached the Brazilian coast, there was always the possibility of meeting up with an English marauder that was raiding Portuguese shipping. The following morning he made a litter for his sea chest and filled it with food and water from the ship's galley, bedding, 2 pistols, 1 pound of gunpowder, 1 supply of shot, flint and steel, 1 sack of tobacco, 1 knife, and 1 Spanish Bible. Then, with nothing else but the clothes on his back, Cuttle set off with his litter for the mists hovering over the peaks of the Andes, taking 1 final look at the forlorn Concepcion, and wondering if perhaps the gods of the Incas were somehow responsible for the catastrophe. Now they had their sacred relics back, he thought, and they were damned welcome to them. The antique jade box with its strange lid came to mind, and he did not envy the next men who came to steal it. Drake returned triumphantly to England, arriving at Plymouth on September 26, 1580, with the Golden Hind's holds bulging with spoils. But he found no sign of Thomas Cuttle and the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción. His backers received a 4,700% profit on their investment, and the Queen's share became the foundation for future British expansion. During a lavish party on board the Hind at Greenwich, Queen Elizabeth conferred knighthood on Drake. The second ship to circumnavigate the world was made a tourist attraction. For 3 generations, She remained on view until finally she either rotted away or burned to the waterline. History doesn't know for certain how it happened, but the Golden Hind vanished into the water of the Thames. Sir Francis Drake continued his exploits for another 16 years. On a later voyage he seized the city ports of Santo Domingo and Cartagena, and became Her Majesty's Admiral of the Seas. He also served as Mayor of Plymouth and a Member of Parliament. And then there was his bold attack on the Great Spanish Armada in 1588. His end came during an expedition to plunder ports and shipping on the Spanish Main in 1596. After succumbing to dysentery, he was sealed in a lead coffin and dropped in the sea near Portobello, Panama. Before his death, hardly a day passed when Drake didn't puzzle over the disappearance of the Concepcion and the enigma of the mysterious jade box and its knotted cords.